And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio 1, and welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. From childhood poet to legendary status is a long, long road, and it's hard to cut this particular story short, so why try, right? Born in London with music in his family and in his blood, Ken Hensley formed the dream of being a rock star at the age of 11 when he bribed his parents into buying him a guitar. Armed with not much more than sheer determination, he moved from step to step, always looking for a way to advance his powerful ambitions. This was achieved through bands like The Gods, which went through several incarnations before recording two albums for EMI Records, and until the formation of Uriah Heep in 1970, the group in which all of his dreams came true and which changed his life forever in many ways. Ken wrote or co-wrote the majority of Uriah Heep's songs during this period, including the hit singles Lady in Black, Livin', as well as Look at Yourself, on which he also sang lead vocals, and Free Me. The band's classic lineup featured Ken Hensley, David Byron, Mick Box, Lee Kerslake, and bassist Gary Thane, plus the management provided by Jerry Ron. During his time with Heap, from 1970 through 80, they recorded 13 studio albums and the acclaimed live album, Uriah Heep Live, on January 1973, along with many compilations and singles. Hensley also recorded his first two solo albums, Proud Words on a Dusty Shelf and Eager to Please, in 1975 during this time. Ken will tell you that he is a first and foremost a writer slash composer slash lyricist, and his enormous history of worldwide hit records is testimony to his, as is his history of worldwide sales of over 40 million records. After returning to Europe from the U.S., Ken Hensley began the climb back into rock and roll history, and in 2007 released the acclaimed rock opera Blood on the Highway. Steadily, Ken grew back into the consciousness of his huge fan base, and either solo or with live fire, the live performances thrilled audiences from Norway to Russia and all points in between. With his classic autobiography, When Too Many Dreams Come True, printed in English, Russian, and Bulgarian, the man who first made his mark in the 20th century is now clearly capturing the 21st. Recent solo releases included on another stunning solo CD, Love and Other Mysteries, in 2013. Cherry Red Records released a brilliant new live fire CD called Trouble, which embodied all the lyrical and musical power of Ken's best efforts with Heap, transformed into a 21st century classic album. Live fire merged some of these great tracks into their live shows as they stormed every market they visited. 2013 also saw a dramatic increase in the demand of Ken's solo shows, and this momentum rolled right into 2014, with Live Fire making its first appearance in Russia, with two sold-out shows in Moscow and Kaluga. With tours in Ukraine, Crimea, Latvia, and Russia, Ken continued to grow the audience for his solo shows, and the legends continued with two memorable concerts on a November rock cruise. Teamed with Steve Weltman, his partner, manager, and friend, they are planning a lot of interesting projects, so stay tuned. It has been said before, and it's worth saying again, Ken Hensley is a rock and roll legend with no plans to stop. It is my great pleasure to welcome singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and producer Ken Hensley to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Ken.
Hi, Ray. It's great to be here.
Was that a mouthful?
It was a long story, wasn't it?
it's a very interesting musical career you've had, you know, and it's a long one.
Yeah, it's a very long one, and it's been interesting, been great, and the turns that it's taken over the years have absolutely amazed even me. So, especially after being out of it for so long, for 15 of the years that I lived in the States, coming back into it wasn't easy, but I've just found all these little new directions and everything, and so it's great to still be extremely active and extremely busy, right? I'm very thankful.
Well, new directions is a good thing, and I think most of these legendary rock heroes like yourself have found other projects and are enjoying it, you know, which I've been finding that a lot. First of all, your former bandmate from the glory days of Uriah Heep, drummer Lee Kerslake, is a Facebook friend of mine, and I messaged him about our interview, and Lee said that he sends his love and says he'll be sticking wings on flies. Do you know what that means?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, it's the name of a silly song from the first Gods album. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
You had to repeat that.
Oh, well, Lee looks like he's doing better anyway. I know he's been ill for a while. Do you still talk to Lee?
Yeah, I talk to him a couple, three times a week, and I see him as often as possible when I go to the UK.
Right.
I mean, the poor guy's, you know, really up against it at the moment, but he's got a great attitude, and if that is a help, it will contribute towards his keeping alive and eventually getting rid of that thing. But it's pretty radical at the moment.
Yeah, that's a shame. He's a good guy and a great drummer. And, you know, like you said, he's
the only drummer that knows how to play July Morning properly. Believe me, I've played with some great drummers in the days since Heap, and none of them have ever got it quite right. When I've played with Lee, like I did last October in the reunion concert,
right?
He's the only guy who has that right feel for it. You know, but no, I mean, the thing is, it was weird when I was listening to your very kind introduction. I just couldn't help but reflect on the fact that three of the names that you mentioned in that summary introduction of Uriah Heep are actually no longer with us, which makes me even more thankful. I'm just thankful that I am. So in a weird way, Ray, whatever I do now sort of commemorates the relationship I had with those people in those days and all the great memories I have of those times.
I was a huge Uriah Heep fan, and I mean, a big time. I used to have a Uriah Heep shirt and wore it in high school. And, I think when the live album came out, I think that really sparked you guys into, you know, superstardom. I mean, that was a fantastic album. And I talked to Mick. We did an interview a few years ago, and he was saying that I think the Kiss Alive album mimicked the Uriah Heep live album, because they were in all of you guys.
That's entirely possible. I mean, I'm not that familiar with that particular record, so I can't say categorically that I can see any similarities, because like I said, I'm not familiar with it, but it's entirely possible. I mean, they toured with us, they opened for us in 73,
yep,
and then ironically we opened for them in 76, I think it was, but no, I mean, Kiss is Kiss, and they'll always be what they've always been, I think.
You live in, is it the village of Agos near Alicante? Is that how you say it, in Spain?
I live near there, yeah. We're about 7 kilometers. That's the village of our municipality. We're registered there, but we live out in the desert in a pretty isolated place. So it's great. The tranquility is fantastic. There's space for all our animals, and Monica's got a wonderful farm, including an organic vegetable farm, and I have the peace and quiet I need to write and create and everything else. So it's a very good situation, right?
Oh, it's a perfect place for that. Is your wife Spanish? Is she from Spain?
Yeah, she was born in France, moved to Spain at an early age, and got fed up with it and left when she was about 18 and moved to America.
Right.
And that's where she grew up, and it's still her favorite country in the whole world. She has dual citizenship, and she forced me to learn to speak Spanish soon
good
after
for her.
We moved here.
Good for her. But my mother's side of the family was from Catalonia, and my grandfather spoke Catalan, which, you know, is a language of its own.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately, they teach their kids Catalan in Catalonia, and I often wonder where the heck they're going to work after they graduate from school. Nobody outside of Catalonia understands a word of Catalan, so I hope they're learning English as well.
Yeah, it's like learning Latin, I guess, you know. Besides church, where are you going to talk Latin, you know?
I did Latin for 6 years in school, and the only thing I was told was that when I grow up, I can be a doctor and write prescriptions.
Or a priest.
I've never been a doctor. I don't write prescriptions, and I don't think they write in Latin anymore. But I always loved languages when I was in school, especially English, and I learned French and German, studied Latin, didn't really learn it, can't remember much of it, but I had a little bit of a flair for languages, so picking up basic conversational Spanish wasn't too difficult for me.
Right. Now, you spend time and you're going back to Russia. Have you picked up some Russian as well?
No, I know about 6 words.
Yep.
I know milk, butter, hello, goodbye, thank you, and please. And that's about it. I can't get to grips with languages that don't use the Roman alphabet.
Right. All
like
I know
Japanese,
is
Chinese, and all those. I can't get to grips with them because the symbols don't. It's hard for me to even imagine how you would learn that.
When I see Chinese and Japanese and the way they write is, to me, that's, you know, like it's art, you know. I don't know how anybody can figure out the Chinese writing. It's amazing. It really is.
No, me neither, but I'm quite happy with all the languages that I've currently got, Ray, so I'm not going to bother with any other ones.
Well, let's catch up on your latest endeavors. Let's see. You had... with Ken Hensley and Live Fire, you released Faster in 2011. Live Fire Live,
right.
That was in 2013. Trouble, 2013. You had solo albums, Love and Other Mysteries in 2012, and Live Tales, which was in April of 2013. What do you got going on nowadays?
I'm writing for a new album, but this writing was interrupted by an unlikely alliance that I formed with an organization in the far east of Russia called the Amur Tiger Foundation, which worked hard for years to save that beautiful creature from extinction.
Right.
And they called on me to go and play a concert during their week of celebrations. And also at the same time, they asked me to write a theme song for their foundation. Being an animal lover, it wasn't too much of a challenge, although I realized quickly that it's a little bit different from writing a love song. I mean, it was a song where I had to get inside the head of a tiger, imagine I was being hunted, and then sort of develop the song from there. But it turned out really well. It was a great challenge. It was really interesting. And that's now developed into, we're going to do a video. And they've asked me to write more songs, which will accompany the video. So I'm busy writing other songs to complete the story of the animal's transition from being a hunted, fearful creature to, you know, a successful redevelopment. There's now over 700 adults in existence in the forest of Russia and the north of China.
Really?
And so that's one project. Yeah, that's one project that I'm working on. And you mentioned in your, again, very kind intro, the album Blood on the Highway, which is an album that I really love, which was horrendously underpromoted, but which I own the rights to now, and which is going to be repackaged and re-released. But that's going to develop into the concept we have right now is we're going to develop it into a stage musical. And I'm writing additional songs for the story as well as some dialogue which will go into the actual story. My partner in that project has all of the right people in place. He's also quite senior in the business and knows his way around. And so that, as soon as I get back from Moscow on the 10th of December, I'm going to start developing those songs. The ideas are on paper now, but they'll become songs when I can focus on them a little bit more clearly. So that'll take me, it's going to take a while to get that done because it's a huge, huge project. I mean, writing for an album is one thing. Writing for a musical is something completely different. So
definitely, yeah.
I'm working on my second autobiography, and I'm going to at some point publish a book of my poetry, which is, goes all the way back to when I was like 9 years old. So
mm-hmm.
I have enough to keep me busy for a while.
I think so. Definitely.
But it's all really based around, I mean, you say, you know, that you've spoken to a number of, you know, artists from
right.
My era, the 70s, if you want to call it, late 60s and the 70s, and who have found alternate ways of, you know, brokering their talent into something useful, meaningful, and profitable. That's not easy. It's really not easy because the industry kind of challenges any progressive thinking on anybody from anybody, you know, above 35. I think
mm-hmm.
you know, it's like it's an institution that's hard to challenge because it's all run by money. But the thing is that for me, what's kept me going and what's always found new paths for me is my writing. That's where it started with my young poetry, and that's really what's kept me moving forward. In other words, looking on the, you know, scanning the distant horizon, I've always seen opportunities because I know I can write my way into and out of anything. And so I think that's what's made the difference for me. I also know many of my contemporaries from those years, Ray, who sadly are, you know, floundering. And so I'm working also with an organization in England, which helps musicians from my era who are struggling, you know, to pay rent and,
right.
and pay the bills and, you know, stuff like that. So it's many pronged. I mean, I'm doing loads and loads of different things and always ready to try anything new. So it's, you know, I'm just lucky to have the health and strength to do these things, right? And so, you know, I do my best. And Monica and I do our best to help, you know, people that are less fortunate than ourselves in a personal sense as well. So it's a lot going on, but it's a great focus, and I wake up every morning very thankful that I've got, you know, lots of things to do and lots of, you know, lots of future to look forward to.
Well, God bless you, Ken, for helping, you know, those that are, you know, not as fortunate, you know, and, you know, your music, you know, sometimes I don't think some of the great artists really understand what their music really means to some of their fans. It's not just being a fan, because the music is like a religion, you know, and in some cases, mm-hmm. the music is religion to many, many people, you know, and, you know, and it gets a lot of people through some hard times. You know, I've talked to people that have listened to music in foxholes in Vietnam. If it wasn't for that music, they said they would have never made it, you know. So,
You know, that's very interesting you should say that, because I only came to this realization quite recently, really. I mean, at the time when I was running around being a rock star when I was young, rich, and stupid, I never realized that there was an element of responsibility that went with all of that.
Exactly.
Until I started to really sit down and talk to people who explained to me what the songs meant to them. And, you know, it was kind of staggering because, you know, I mean, when I write a song, like, let's say July Morning, for example, mm-hmm. when I wrote that song, I can, many, many Russians who were prohibited from even owning Western rock during the Soviet era have told me that what it meant to them was freedom.
Right.
And the word freedom doesn't enter into the song. It doesn't enter into, it didn't enter into my thinking when I was composing the song either. So, you know, then I suddenly start to think to myself, you know what? It's really good that I write the way I do, because it means that people can go behind the lines, not between them. There's never anything between the lines, but they can go behind the lines and make the songs mean anything they want to. And I've read recently a couple of interviews with writers much more famous than me who've expressed a similar thing, that the real skill in writing, whether you realize it or not, which I didn't, is that you enable the reader to consume the listener to consume whatever they're consuming and turn it into whatever they want to turn it into. I didn't know, of course, that I was doing that, but this realization came recently. And then also I realized that, you know, by the grace of God, my music will live longer than me.
Right.
So it's a good feeling to know that I'll leave something useful behind.
But yeah, you said it. I mean, you know, sometimes artists think, well, this is what it means. You know, I was talking to Steve Hackett about Entangled, you know, which meant a lot to me. And you know, he said, you know, it meant one thing, and I took it to mean other things. You know,
right. Course,
you know, it was a psychiatrist person laying on a psychiatrist's couch and that kind of thing. But you know, I had some other meaning, you know, like when I was in the hospital and they put you under and you go into this, you know, kind of a dream world and things like that. It meant a lot more to me. And, you know, just like your song, like you said, July Morning and also Sunrise was very, very important to so many people.
Right.
You know, and, yeah.
Well, it's a phenomenal thing. And like I said, I came to the realization of it late in life, but it hasn't changed the way I go about writing, right?
Right,
I still
right.
go about writing the same way. I just respond to the things that I see, hear, read, whatever, and sometimes it just triggers a thought in my head and instantly becomes a bunch of words, which hopefully at certain times become new songs. So I haven't changed it. I haven't sat down and said, oh, well, I must deliberately concentrate on my responsibility here.
Yeah.
I just keep doing what I've been doing and let it happen naturally and organically. And I enjoy writing very much. And I don't write for a target. I don't write for a record company or a publisher
right.
or anything, although I have a great publisher. I don't write specifically for anyone. I just write what comes naturally. And then if it has a destination or it finds a destination, then that's a bonus.
You know, with your lyrics and Heap, I could see you writing the next, you could be the next, you know, series of Harry Potter books, you know, if you really wanted to go that way, because, the imagination and everything you put in, the fantasy and all that in your lyrics, I mean, if you only start writing about, you know, maybe stories or, fiction.
Hmm.
You ever thought about that?
No, it's an interesting thought because, you know, I mean, I do have a rampant imagination, but I mean, when I wrote my first autobiography, When Too Many Dreams Come True, I found that it was much, much more difficult to write a book, for example, than it was to write a song.
Mm-hmm.
And when it went to the publisher, the first draft went to the publisher, he said, which is very nice, but it's rather like a long letter. And so they had to bring in a guy from Rolling Stone in Germany, which is a friend of mine, Matthias Penzel.
Right.
And Matthias actually managed to extract more information from me during 3 days of interviews and frame the whole thing so that it was much more readable as an autobiography. So whether or not I could actually come up with, you know, I probably could come up with a title and a story, but, you know, whether I could come up with anything that was as meaningful as something like wonderful, like Harry Potter, I don't know. But it might be something I'll turn to when I'm too old to go on the road or something. Maybe I'll settle down and try to do that. But I tell you, this musical is going to be a real challenge. But again, its foundation is the story of my own life.
Mm-hmm.
Like Blood on the Highway was, it was the story of a rock star in the 70s.
Right.
Well, you know, its foundation is going to be that. I've got masses of material to draw on. That's the thing. And fortunately, I can remember most of it.
That's a miracle in itself.
Yes, it is.
How big is this production going to be? I mean, you know, how many people need to audition and that kind of thing?
Oh, gosh, I'm nowhere near that.
You're not close to that yet.
I mean, that will be handled by other people. I mean, what I will do is I will take Blood on the Highway. I will focus on the songs that are really meaningful within that concept, and then I will add and punctuate the story with fleshed-out things, you know, stories about when I was young and when I was stupid, and along comes the man who's the manager who puts up all the money, and then, you know, he who giveth eventually takes away. You know, I can flesh the story out substantially whilst also adding some dialogue in there about some of the really stupid things we did when we were on the road, which seemed funny at the time. But, you know, I think you can make the story, flesh the story out and make it a lot more interesting. But once I finish my part,
right,
which is not unsubstantial, I mean, it's a substantial part, then it will be handed over to professionals who write these kinds of stories all the time and know how to write them for stage. So, I mean, our goal is ambitious, but I couldn't tell you where it might end up because it's uncharted water for me. It's completely new territory for me. But my part in it is what I'm used to doing, which is, you know, the creative writing aspect, and I'm comfortable there.
Yeah, I think it's interesting how you can create a musical, you know, and it's all from the lyrics. Like, you know, Jesus Christ Superstar, you know, how that came about
right.
And everything, you know. I think that's very, very cool, actually.
Well, we'll see where it goes. And if you and I manage to stay in touch over the over the years, well, I'll keep you posted on it. But, you know, like I said, the partner, my main partner in the whole project is extremely experienced in terms of the business end of all this.
Right, right.
And so, you know, if I just place my work in his hands, I know it'll end up in a good destination. So
mm-hmm.
I'll be fascinated to see how they flesh it out and how they turn it into something visual.
Yeah. There's actually a couple of artists that are doing something like that. Tommy James from the Shondells. He's doing his story, but he's having a hard time. It was supposed to be out already, his musical, and I don't know what's going on. He was on the show, but his life, you know, he got tangled up with the mafia. The record company was owned by the mafia, and they were the same characters from The Sopranos. That's where they got The Sopranos from. And
I didn't know that.
Yeah, Morris Levy was his boss, who was a big mob guy. So he wrote a book, and then from the book, they're doing the play, and they want to turn it into a movie. But it's been out there for now a good 6-7 years. I don't know what's been delaying it, because it should have, you know, gone somewhere by now. But that's interesting.
Yeah, the thing is, though, to move it from the creative moment, relatively, there's no heavy cost. It's not prohibitive in terms of cost because it's just time that you've got to finance, really, more than anything else. But to go from there to the full production and so on, then you start to involve marketing people and everything else. And all they're going to do is they're going to sit and say, how can I monetize this? How can I
–
is this thing going to make me any money?
That's where it gets
delayed. That's basically what all record companies, what all production companies, what all these people do.
Yeah.
I mean, their final analysis is they'll take this little diamond that you present them with and see if they can polish it shiny enough to be able to make money out of it, because
exactly. That's
the only thing they care about.
Yeah.
So it could be that Tommy's project, and I wish him the best with it. I don't know him personally, but I wish him the best with it. It could be that it's bogged down in some people that are just sitting there saying, well, this thing's just not going to make any money. Nobody's going to buy it.
Right.
And if it gets to that point, it'll be bogged down forever.
I know. Yeah. Yeah, which is a shame.
In
you know, in the old days, sure. There's a great video out by Frank Zappa talking about the music industry back then, and he used to say that the young guys that they would hire, the hip guys that think they know everything about the music industry, would never take a chance on anything new. But the guys with the cigars that didn't know too much about the music industry itself would take a chance. You know, they'd sit it out there, try it out at least, and see if it made any money.
Right.
You know?
Those people were commonly referred to as visionaries.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And I've just been reading a book. I'm affiliated with Peer Music, which is a wonderful publishing company founded by Ralph Peer back in the early 19th century. And he was a visionary, 100% visionary. And I mean, one of his famous quotes in an interview was, "I don't know anything about music," he said, "because if I knew too much about music, I wouldn't be able to be as good at business."
Right.
And I think the reverse is equally true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I know a lot about music and songwriting, but I don't know anything about music.
Right.
If I studied business and got deeply into things as a business person, and then I might lose track of my gift as a writer. Well, that puts you in a rather invidious position, because then you're at the mercy of whomever you partner with on the business end of things.
Right.
And it's absolutely true that in the 60s and 70s, nobody in our business had any idea what they were doing. But we didn't know what we were doing. The agents, the managers, the record companies, no, because this thing suddenly came up where, instead of wearing ties and short hair and everything else and playing nice, sweet songs for, you know, a mass audience, we were just wearing ugly clothes, growing our hair and playing as loud as we possibly could. And nobody knew what to do with this. Everybody
right.
knew it was phenomenal because we captured the energy of the youth at that time, the post-Vietnam era.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody knew that it was hugely successful and potentially enormous, which it became, but nobody knew how to manage it. So we were all improvising as we went along, and we needed visionaries at that time.
Yeah.
And there were plenty of them around. There were plenty of guys that would give us a chance. They would take something and say, "Well, I don't know if this is any good or not, but let's try it."
Exactly.
And that's when FM radio was a shack in a field with a few guys playing their favorite music, smoking dope, and playing their favorite music to their friends. And, you know, what you've seen what FM radio has become in the recent past. It's corporate and it's totally institutionalized.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this is what also takes away the opportunities, the real opportunities from new artists.
Yeah.
Because they don't have the freedom. They don't have that partnership, which says, let's try it.
Right.
You know, the people just aren't willing to do that anymore. And Ralph was a visionary, and my partner in the musical project is also an established visionary in the business. So, you know, fortunately, there's a few of them still around, but they're very hard to find.
What was Jerry Braun like?
Jerry was great. I mean,
yeah.
Jerry was basically the sixth member of the band.
Mm.
I mean, he financed the whole thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
I went from when I joined the band, it was called Spice at the time,
mm-hmm.
and they wanted a keyboard player, so they asked me, and you know, I went from, you know, struggling with the gods and various things like that to earning 15 quid a week, and for me this was like bloody luxury, and he bought me my first Hammond organ, and you know, he did everything to make it possible for us to do what we did best. He handled all the business. We never knew anything about what we were earning or anything like that. We just knew we were getting paid. He handled all the business. His father had established a huge publishing empire in England. And, you know, he established the agency and the record company and the management company and everything within that framework. And as far as we were concerned, he was like the sixth member of the band. I mean, we would never have achieved what we achieved without him. There's absolutely no doubt about that.
See, he bought
later in life, I'm...
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah, I was going to say, he bought you your first ham in Oregon. I mean, how many people today would do something like that and take a, like you said, take a chance, you know, and develop a band, you know, and, you know, he saw the potential, you know. It's amazing.
Well, the short answer to that is nobody that I know would do that. I know people in this business, very, very few of them, who are willing to go out on a limb a little bit. But those are mainly people who recognize my ability, not just my history, but my ability now, and are willing to bet on that. Mm-hmm. And that's a different story. But if I go to a record company, just laugh me out the building. I mean, what are you doing in here? You're 71 years old. Go and retire and have a lay down or something.
Yeah. It's very sad.
You know, so, I mean, the industry itself is impenetrable as an opportunity for young musicians anymore. Unless they are doing exactly what everybody else is doing, unless they are marketable to the max, then they haven't got a chance.
Yeah, it used to be if you're a proficient musician, you got in. You know, if you're the great guitar player, you're in. I can't even name a great guitar player in a band that's on mainstream radio anymore. You know, I mean, you got the Joe Bonamassas and things like that, but they're not on mainstream radio. You know, nobody is.
No, of course, and they never will be. I mean,
they never will be.
Because they're mainly a product of, you know, GIT, the Guitar Institute of Technology.
Right.
And they all play exactly the same stuff, and
yep.
it's not commercial. I mean, Steve Vai is an incredible guitar player, but what he does is not commercial. It's never going to sell a million copies. Whereas Eddie Van Halen, who, you know, mastered the whole GIT thing and developed his own technique, he was able, through his alliance with his brother and the other musicians in Van Halen, he was able to broker that into something hugely successful. But nobody thinks that way anymore. It's like virtuosity is okay, but it's limited. I mean, Yngwie Malmsteen, what a genius of a guitar player.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, it's not marketable. I mean, you can only market genius up to a point. I mean, it's not commercial. It's not going to get radio, and it's not going to sell in sufficient quantities to be worth the investment that the record companies need to invest. It's simple arithmetic, but at the same time, it's a shame that, you know, we don't have those visionaries anymore in our industry, because then more people, great young musicians, would get a chance, and they're not.
Yep.
And I wonder how much great music we're missing as a result of that.
Oh,
there is
a lot.
Another issue there, though, Ray.
Right.
And that is, in the early 70s, there was hundreds of bands chasing the same dollar. Now there are millions.
Yep.
And because of technology, everybody thinks that they can master the internet and they can master the download situation and everything else. But there's a million other people out there trying to do the same thing. How do you stand out in that situation without a company that's going to market you and promote you and advertise you and everything else? You just can't.
It's
a matter of competition. I mean, we would play festivals with Black Sabbath, Moody mm-hmm. Blues, Deep Purple, Led Zeppelin, all on the same bill. And we were competing with each other,
right.
But at the same time, there was a camaraderie there that carried us into this new era with so much energy. It was unstoppable. Now there's no camaraderie out there. Everybody's just, you know, biting each other and fighting each other. And it's a very unhealthy environment. And where I can't listen to radio anymore, to tell you the truth, when, you know, FM radio or music radio at all, because... You know, we've got a rock station here in Spain that plays, you know, supposed to be real rock, and it plays like old soft Fleetwood Mac stuff. And
I know.
It's like, you know, it's really, really difficult to deal with. But then I'm coming from a very biased opinion, because I lived in and through the golden days of rock and roll.
That's
and,
right.
They're never going to come back. They can't come back, because it was everything was different then.
And, you know, what's sad is there's so many guys from that era that are still producing great albums, great music, and a lot of these guys, some of the music has gotten even better, but they don't have an avenue to you know, that they have it promoted or anything like that, and that's why I started this show, you know, because I was I love that music, you know. I obviously I don't do it for the money, because I don't make any. But I do this to promote the artists that I've loved and they meant, you know, so much to me. And, you know, there needs to be an avenue like this to promote the guys that are the legends, like you.
Well, but to be honest, Ray, I mean, it's a little bit more than that. I mean, you're being quite modest. I mean, what you're doing is perpetuating or at least sustaining
right.
the memory. And that's important because, you know, this whole thing about, well, is rock and roll dead? Well, no, it's not. I mean, it lives in the hearts of people if it doesn't
exactly.
live on their turntables. But the bottom line is, by doing what you're doing, you're reminding our generation of folks of what probably brought them great pleasure in their early life. Plus, you're also kind of nudging younger people into
right.
realizing there's something a little bit more to it than just a downloaded MP3 file, which is systematically lost all the information that the artist worked so hard to put on in the first place.
Yeah.
I mean, I met Professor Brandenburg at a CBIT conference in Dusseldorf or Stuttgart. I can't remember which it was. He was on a panel with me and a genius from IBM.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he was introduced as the inventor of the MP3 file.
Mm.
And somebody asked me what I personally thought of, you know, the MP3 files and everything. And I said, well, quite honestly, I think it's one of the greatest tools that a creative musician can use. I can now write a song, send it to my guitar player over the internet. He can work on it at the other end, and we just keep exchanging these MP3 files. I said, the only problem is they sound like shit.
Pardon
the expression. And
true.
I actually asked Professor Brandenburg, is there anything you can actually do about that? Because it's awful. You know, I create a WAV file or an AIFF file in the studio with about 80 megabytes of information on it, and the kid that downloads an MP3 is getting 5 megabytes of that.
Yeah.
Where's the rest of the information gone?
Right.
And it is gone, but we've lost two generations of listeners already that think an MP3 file is all there is.
Yeah, I know.
So it is a challenge. It's a real challenge. But, I mean, I applaud what you're doing because, you know, we need to let people know there's a lot more to it. And, you know, when kids think or ask or even wonder why they should pay for music, there needs to be a really strong explanation for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm involved a lot with organizations like BASCA, the MCPS, and PRS in England, who are constantly battling against government positions on things like this, where they should all not legislate in order to make sure that creators get paid.
Yeah.
And there's this mentality out there, well, music's cool, it should be free. I mean, why should I pay for music? It's like in the atmosphere. Well, then, you know what? Then let's take a year off. Let's give these people 1 year without one note of music and see what happens.
Yep. You
know
what birds
mean. There's music everywhere, right? I mean, there's
yep.
music in the song of the birds. There's music in the rustling of the trees.
Yep.
There's music everywhere.
Yep.
And the world is full of vibrations. And you know, we capture that and turn it into something that everyone can listen to.
That's right.
And why that shouldn't be compensated for, I can't imagine that anybody even thinks that. I mean, it's just like saying, well, a guy should make a movie and I should not have to pay to go to the movie theater and watch it because
yeah,
it's,
same thing.
It's
yeah.
mine.
Yep. Thanks to
so
Napster.
Anyway. But anyway,
Napster started all this.
I'm getting off my soapbox now.
Talking about mainstream radio, after I experienced the live album, which, you know, I listened to over and over and over again by Uriah Heep, I was like a little kid waiting for the Sweet Freedom album to be distributed. You know, I kept, you know, waiting. Mm-hmm. I went out to my record store, and I said, when is this thing coming out? When is this thing? And then when Stealin' came out, it was actually played on Top 40 radio stations, and I was ecstatic. I said, man, Uriah Heep's on Top 40, you know, and then... I talked to Mick about this. He says it was on Top 40 for a while, and then it got taken off because people started complaining about the lyric. I'd done The Rancher's Daughter, and
yeah.
I... Yeah.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Give me a break.
That's crazy.
Absolutely true. He was dead right about that.
He says that he says, and Heap still plays it today. And he says Ken wrote some tremendous songs in that time, very powerful. That's one of the comments he made to me. But that was a great song, and that, you know, that took Uriah Heep to a different level, I think, you know, because it did hit mainstream radio, and it's still remembered kind of like that way, you know.
Oh yeah, it's a song that's heavily in demand. I mean, when I play band shows as opposed to solo shows, we always include that song in the show because people just love it, and they love to just sing the words at the end. Mm-hmm. They love to sing Stevie, and it doesn't matter where we go.
Yep.
Whatever language they speak, they know how to say stealing. So, and that's another thing, casting back to earlier in our conversation. I mean, I play in Russia a lot, Bulgaria, Belarus,
yep,
many former Soviet countries, where, you know, I'll play to a solo show where it's just me and my piano, my guitars, and my book of songs. And I'll play all these songs, and it gives me an opportunity not to tell them what the song means, but where the song came from,
mm-hmm,
and how it started life. You know, I play it the way I wrote it. And there might be 700 people in the building. There might be 1,000 people in the building. The show is designed for a smaller audience, not a spectacular audience. There might be, you know, let's say there's 700 people there, none of which speak English, but all of which know how to sing the songs. They, you know, when I come to the chorus of July Morning, and, you know, they're all right there with me, singing away. And,
yep.
it's amazing. It's absolutely amazing. And as you said, I mean, music transcends so many barriers and unites people, unifies people in a way that nothing else can.
You and Mick had such a great, you know, the way you played together. I mean, like in July Morning, the organ in the beginning, and then he comes in with, you know, that heavy metal, heavy rock guitar. It just, you know, meshed so well, you know, you guys together. It was so cool.
Well, I tell you, we didn't design that, but it just happened by accident. And
really?
It's something I do. It's something I do today. I mean, wherever, mm-hmm, Mick played,
right,
I would register what I played on the Hammond, either just above him or just below him in terms of pitch. So when it combined, it created another energy altogether. So this was just something that happened instinctively, like everything did in those days. And, I mean, I still do it. I still work with, you know, my guitar players and everyone to help them to understand it. What's important is that we don't play on top of each other, that we play a little bit separated but blended so that it creates this extra energy. It's not a science, right? Believe me.
I think most great songs aren't science. I think they're just kind of, you know, maybe improvised.
That's
the glory of it. Yeah. You know, I love David Byron. You know, he was so,
yeah, me too.
And and it was so sad the way, you know, he passed away. I know he had an alcohol abuse problem. How difficult was it to fire David Byron?
Gosh, it was really difficult, but much more difficult later than it was at the time, because,
uh-huh,
you know, obviously David's alcoholism was not only just destroying himself and his career, but it was destroying us too.
Yeah,
he was our front man. He was the mouthpiece of the band, and perfect example. We go to the Spectrum in Philadelphia, and we sell it out. 20,000 people, no problem. We made a big strategic mistake with our travel arrangements and logistics at the time. Ended up staying at the gig after sound check instead of going back to the hotel. And, you know, backstage, there's all everything there that you can imagine. And David finished a bottle of Shivers Regal and was blind drunk before we went on stage. And this had never happened before. And first thing that happened, goes on stage and he steps on the microphone stand. The microphone comes back, hits him in the mouth and splits his lip. So he's now bleeding.
Right.
So he spends the night cursing the audience. And, you know, audiences don't like that kind of thing. And the following year, we barely sold out the Fox Theater, which is 3,000 people. So that was the kind of damage that was being done.
Huh.
But, But we blew it there. I mean, you know, the thing is, people often ask me, you know, could we have done more for him? Could we have done more for Gary? And, you know, the easy answer is no,
right.
Because if
yeah.
somebody doesn't want to help themselves, then
true.
You can't help them. But the better answer is, yes, we could have done more. What we could have done,
mm-hmm.
if our manager hadn't have been so greedy,
right.
is we could have taken a few months off and given these people a chance to rehab and
right.
and really find out if they could beat the thing, you know, and help them that way. But, you know, everybody was making so much money, the business people were making so much money that they didn't want to kill the golden goose. They didn't even want to give the golden goose a week off. So
that's sad. Very sad.
We let them down. I think we let them down. We can't be held responsible or be blamed for it, but we did let them down because there was more we could have done. And David, he was my hero. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I wrote all the songs I wrote with his voice in mind, with his phrasing in mind, with his registers in mind. I knew David's voice better than anybody other than himself.
Yeah.
And so when I sat down to write a song, and even now I still do think about that. I mean, I must admit that, you know, when I write a new song, I can almost hear David singing it because he was so special. He was the best interpreter of my lyrics. And a much better interpreter even than I am myself, really, because mm-hmm. he was more objective about it. And I couldn't be objective about my own lyrics. And so I missed him a lot. But, you know, the other mistake we made was we said, well, we're going to replace him. Well, you just simply can't do that. You can't replace anyone. I mean, we got another singer, but that's not a replacement. You know,
right.
that's just another person. And the actual chemistry of the band, the chemistry which made the band as big as it was destroyed
right.
from the moment Gary was asked to leave the band. We replaced him with John Wetton, great bass player,
yep.
great arranger, great singer, thoroughly unreliable human being in terms of being on time for sessions and things like that, because he was still working with Brian Ferry.
Right.
But, you know, on paper, a great person to fill those shoes. Well, yeah, but it wasn't Gary.
It wasn't Gary, right?
It was the chemistry. It was the chemistry between me, Mick, Gary, David, and Lee.
Mm-hmm.
There was a magic there,
yep.
and when that was broken, everything started to fall apart. And then with David, fell apart even more. That
mm-hmm.
was when I started trying to leave the band.
Yep.
But was talked out of it constantly by Jerry Brun. One more album, one more
right.
tour. You know, blah, blah,
right.
blah, blah. And I sort of fell for it. And, you know, I was in the band for 4 years or so, longer than I really wanted
yeah.
to be.
Yeah, I think you left in around 1980 or so, right?
Yes, I did. June of 1980, actually.
Yeah, I could tell the musical direction was changing a bit. I remember when Wonderworld came out, I mean, I was happy. I was okay with it. And I love the album cover, of course. That was so cool, you know. And I don't know. I think it was when you change singers, when David was not a singer anymore. I think that's when I lost interest in Heap. You know?
Well, yeah, because we changed to John Lawton, who was
wasn't
a very
same.
Very good singer.
Yeah,
but he was a blues rock singer, not a pop rock singer. He was a
right.
completely different style of singer from David, and so that diluted the music in many ways. And not always good. And, you know, if you go to an album like High and Mighty, well, that was condemned generally
Mighty, right?
by management, record company and everything because, this is not a Heap album. Well, of course it's not a Heap album. It's like, I'm the only one that brought any songs to the sessions.
Right.
And when we laid down the basic track, the band went to the pub and I just stayed there and did my thing. So
yeah.
it's like a solo album using Uriah Heap as a band.
Yeah.
So of course it's not a Uriah Heep album, but, you know, I'm not going to stop just because everybody thinks that we should do things differently. I mean, I've got a mission, I've got a goal, and I want to pursue it, and I'm going to. And I was bloody minded in that respect, but
yeah.
it was sad that the band basically gave up, to be honest. But it was inevitable because the band was those original five guys.
That's
and,
right.
It couldn't be that anymore.
And, you know, you were the signature, to me, you were the signature sound. Yeah, it's kind of like John Lord with Deep Purple, you know what I mean? Without John
uh-huh.
Lord, you know, you just can't have Deep Purple. it's not the same anymore. And not only did you contribute that sound, but you wrote all the lyrics.
Well, that's true too. But I mean, in every project that I've been involved in, whether it was mm-hmm. The Gods or Uriah Heep or things I've done since,
right?
I mean, it's been the songs which have been my most important contribution. My musical contribution is secondary to that, because what I do musically springs from the songs themselves. So with Purple, yeah, you had John, and Richie was a formidable presence there.
Yep.
But after Richie left, and it was only John. I mean, they replaced Richie with a bunch of, you know, like I said, you know, accomplished GIT graduates, and
right.
And it really didn't have the spirit anymore. And I mean, I know the Purple guys real well.
Yep.
And I knew them then, and I know them now. And you know, we had food fights at each of our houses and everything else. And you know, we knew each other extremely well. But the thing is that what's happened is so much changed. Once the spell was broken. Once Richie did his thing, and then Gillan came in, and everything. Yeah, it sounded like Deep Purple in the same way that Heap always sounded like Heap. Well, until John Sloman, then it sounded like Gino Vannelli. But it sounded like it, but it didn't feel like it.
No.
It didn't feel like it at all.
Yeah.
And so that was the difference. That was the huge difference for me, was it just didn't feel right. And you know, I've got a bunch of guys that I play with now who bring me closer to that feeling than anything I've done since, because they honor the music, and but they add themselves to it, which is what everybody always did in those days.
Yeah, I was very lucky. I saw the classic lineup of Heap several times. The first one, I think it was in 73 in Baltimore. You guys headline, and listen to this. It was you, Earth, Wind, and Fire, and the debut of ZZ Top.
Yeah, I believe it.
Yeah.
I believe it. You could package tours like that then.
Yeah, it was pretty cool, you know.
My favorite tours was when it was Heap, Deep Purple, and Buddy Miles.
Oh, my gosh.
No, I mean, nobody would package a tour like that anymore. I mean,
not at all.
Even think about it. So, but Baltimore, that would have been where? I'm trying to think of the, I'm trying to flash back to the venue.
Civic Center. Baltimore Civic Center.
Civic Center. Okay.
Civic
fine.
Center, yeah.
It was always
sold
one
out.
Of our strongholds. It was always a great place to play.
Yeah, Baltimore. You were very, very popular in Baltimore and in D.C. I saw you at the Capitol Center. With Blue Oyster Cult, and that's when John Wetton came in. Yeah. But it was still a great band. I never noticed anything about David, you know, being sloppy or anything. He was always, when I saw him, very, very professional. It must have happened later, or maybe, no?
No, it did. It happened later, but not long after that, because by that time the band was flying so high.
Yeah.
And like I said, we were all young and rich and stupid, and we weren't getting any real guidance at that point. What we were getting was a management company that was insisting that we produce a new album every 10 months, which in my opinion was completely unnecessary.
Yep.
And also from my own personal point of view, completely difficult to comply with, because I've got to write songs and for a new album. And I'm already on tour. I'm writing in the toilet. I'm writing on the plane. I'm writing in the limo. I'm writing everywhere, just desperately trying to come up with stuff. And an album's really suffered as a result of that.
Yeah.
Best example is The Magician's Birthday.
Right.
The Magician's Birthday is not even 15% of what it could have been if they'd have allowed me to finish writing it.
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, you just titled your next book "Young, Rich, and Stupid." That's a perfect title.
No, I can't do that. I'm not good at titles. I generally farm out some ideas and let somebody else come up with a reasonable and rational idea why it should be called something else. But in the Heap days when we would finish an album. And this is a flashback for you. We would all be talking about, we'd go to dinner and we'd be talking about what's going to be the single from the album and everything. And I would always say, Rain. Rain Should Be the Sequel just because I like the song. But of course, it's completely stupid as a radio song and everything else.
Right.
I never could pick a single. Everybody else is much better at picking singles than me, so I'd depend on others like yourself. Young, Rich and Stupid. At the moment, my second autobiography is draft titled Who Am I? And so maybe Young, Rich and Stupid is better, but Young, Rich and Stupid sounds like it might belong better in the musical concept.
Yeah.
Because there's a possibility that, you know, I might need that as a frame of reference at some point in the musical concept.
I think it's great. I think it's a great title.
We'll see.
We'll see, right? You know, Mick told me, he says, we felt when we were on stage, we were untouched and unbeatable. And what made Uriah Heep so different than other bands during that time. But and I agree with you. I mean, you guys, everybody I've talked to says you guys were so polished and so professional on stage. And I guess, like you said, it was just the magic. You know, it's just the magic and how you guys mesh well with each other.
Well, that was the key, but there were other elements there. You know, when you say polished and professional and everything else, I mean, we did work hard.
Yeah.
I mean, we rehearsed for ages before tours. We were in pre-production before albums, which is why we could knock out an album in, you know, 6 weeks.
It's amazing.
We worked hard. We worked really, really hard. We dedicated ourselves to what we knew what we wanted to accomplish, and we knew it was going to take hard work to get there. So we did the hard work. So
yep.
What you saw on stage at the end of the day wasn't the result of just five guys showing up and jamming. It was the result of five guys showing up who had spent a month or so preparing for that beforehand.
Yeah.
And always did sound check, never missed out on the important preparation point. So there were some mechanical issues in there as well as the spiritual issues, right?
Yeah, it showed on stage. I mean, you guys were, you know, you blew out a lot of people.
Well, that's true, and you know, it, with a little change of attitude, we could have kept it going for quite a lot longer.
I think
unfortunately,
so.
Unfortunately, we lost the focus, and shifted away from the music, and then we never quite got it back.
Yeah. Ken, here's a question that I ask everyone that I interview, and I get some very interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
For me, it would be Leonard Cohen.
Leonard Cohen, who just passed. Yep.
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 He was and still is my songwriting hero. He was somebody in my list of 20 songs I wish I had written. He has at least four. Don Henley has a couple, Dolly Parton has one. But I've always adored his music, and I did get to meet him in 1973 in Munich and talk with him for a little while, but it was more meaningful for me than it was for him, I've no doubt. But just the way he paints pictures with words, to me, compared to the genius of somebody like Strauss or Debussy, for example, who paints pictures without words.
Right.
These are things to strive for me as a composer. These are things which I reach out for all the time. And I'm very proud of one new song which I have where the verses have to be sung in a very low voice. And so I call them my Leonard Cohen verses. And, I never knew the man, but I knew him through his music. And, you know, it was very sad that he died. But, man, he left a body of work behind him that will live forever. And that would be the person I would love to have collaborated with, although God only knows what I would have added to what he'd done. I doubt it would have been any. I just would have been sitting there with my eyes wide open, my mouth open, and maybe that would have helped him a little bit.
Yeah, that would have been an interesting musical collaboration, for sure.
Who knows?
Yeah.
It'll never happen until we get to heaven.
Yeah. Ken, anything else you'd like to promote?
nothing at all. I don't want to promote anything, Ray. I'm just You're happy
busy.
To talk to you, and through you to talk to my friends and fans that are out there, and tell them to celebrate the fact they're still alive, and celebrate the fact that we're still making great music, and to always insist on making sure that, you know, rock and roll doesn't die.
Exactly. Well, we're looking forward to some great things from you. The musical, of course, that's, you know, we're all sitting at the edge of our seats, you know, waiting to see how that all comes about. You've got a new book coming out. We want to touch bases with you again when all that gets a little bit closer, for sure, so we can heavily market you and everything you got going.
Let's talk again in the middle of next year, and by that time things should be a lot clearer.
That'll be wonderful.
Many of the pieces of those puzzles are already in place. I already have a book full of songs, so I could go into the studio tomorrow and cut an album.
Great.
And that wouldn't be a problem.
Right.
But we've moved in some slightly different directions here, which are a little more challenging. So I'll reserve the easy bit for later.
Mm-hmm.
But let's touch base middle of next year, and I'll give you all the updates that I can.
That'll be wonderful. Ken, thank you so much again for being on the show today and for all the great music you've given us through the years and into the future. And my best to your wife as well.
No, thank you, Ray. She'll appreciate that. And I just thank you for the opportunity to have this conversation. It's been very enjoyable.
Thank you, Ken. Me too. Take care, man.
Okay, man.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Visit Ken Hensley's official website at www.ken/Hensley.com. Visit Ken Hensley on Facebook as well, www.facebook.com/officialKenHensley. And Ken Hensley's on Twitter, www.twitter.com/KenHensleyMusic. Very special thanks to Steve Weltman Consultancy for arranging this interview, and to Doug and Don Newsom with VBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Coming up next show, Henry Paul, singer, guitarist, songwriter for the Outlaws. Join me biweekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on the Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on the Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at ray@publicityworksagency.com. Don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to be Politically Incorrect in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. You'll live it, and it'll make a great stocking stuffer. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on PBS Radio, Station 1.